Okay, I'd like to bring to order the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee. We have a busy schedule today. We are hearing the Fritz bill first, and then we are hearing Aaron Murphy's bill, and then we will have some presentations by the Department of Human Services on the Child Care Services Grants, and a report on estimated costs for conducting annual license reviews and school readiness connections program. But first of all, we need to approve the minutes. Representative Normus, have you read the minutes?
I did. That's why I put them on the agenda.
Would you like to move for approval? Okay, good. Representative Normus moves approval of the minutes for February 26th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. I also want to thank Representative Blythe for chairing the committee when I became sick. There apparently is something going around, members. I hope you are all staying healthy because it hits you quite suddenly. So thank you for doing that. And I heard the committee went really well.
Well, we carried on as best we could without you.
Oh, yeah. I know. Actually, you start to feel sort of that you are not, that you're are dispensable, or whatever. They canceled my schedule. Nobody really missed me. I thought, well, you know,
that's probably true.
So you can carry on just fine. Representative Fritz, would you like to move your bill in order to get it for the committee?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes, I would. I'd like to move House File 3197 to be included.
Laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Fritz moves House File 3197 be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Learning Finance Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. If you'd like to begin your testimony, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I would like to, first of all, begin with the fact that, you know, I am a grandmother of 17 beautiful grandchildren. And I have a couple of nurses in the family, and I just got off the phone with one of them who was a pediatric nurse and was named Nurse of the Year in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I'm happy to share that and to share that with these two folks who are here to testify, because I wanted to ask her again about South Dakota, but she didn't know the answer. So we're going to talk about Minnesota. And we're going to talk about child care providers and the piece of legislation that I bring forward today, Madam Chair and members, is the placing of an infant to sleep in a license holder, that the license holder must place the infant on its back unless the license holder has a documentation from a doctor directing the alternative sleeping position, such as the abdomen. So it is addressed with further ado, that is, in essence, the bill, the piece of the bill that I have. It is now with parental consent, not doctor's prescription. So that's, I have two testifiers here that I'd like to turn this time over to, and they could tell you more. And to my right, I have Kathleen Fernbach, the far right, and we're going to start with her.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
if you could
you.
State your name for the record.
Kathleen Fernbach. Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and committee members. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Kathleen Fernbach, and I'm a public health nurse and director of the Minnesota Sudden Infant Death Center at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. The Minnesota Sudden Infant Death Center is a statewide program that provides information and counseling services to families as well as child care providers who experience the sudden death of an infant from any cause. We also promote risk reduction education and initiatives and participate in research. Today I'm here to testify on behalf of Child Care Work, an organization that strives to achieve and sustain high quality child care for the families and communities of Minnesota. We support the proposed child care licensing regulation that a doctor's prescription be required to allow a child care provider to place an infant in her care on his tummy for sleep. In keeping with best practice and evidence-based medicine, such a doctor's exemption would apply to unusual medical conditions and not to healthy infants. For example, an infant with oxygen-requiring chronic lung disease or an upper airway malformation might require a tummy sleeping position if determined by his physician. In 1994, findings from multiple research studies compel the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Institutes of Health, and other organizations to launch a campaign called Back to Sleep. This campaign promotes the infant care practice of placing healthy infants on their backs to sleep as a way to reduce the risk of sudden infant death syndrome or SIDS. Since the beginning of the Back to Sleep campaign, the SIDS rate in the United States has decreased approximately by 53%. Prior to the Back to Sleep campaign, in the United States, it was reported approximately 6,000 SIDS deaths a year. In 2005, the most current national data available, the United States reported 2,100 SIDS deaths. Minnesota has experienced a comparable decline during this time as well. Prior to the Back to Sleep campaign, Minnesota reported approximately 110 deaths annually from SIDS. In 2005, the number of Minnesota infant deaths attributed to SIDS was 44. This is a dramatic decline as a result of a very simple change in a basic infant care practice. In order to further reduce infant death due to SIDS, the American Academy of Pediatrics has begun the Healthy Child Care America Initiative. This initiative promotes safe sleep policies in child care settings and urges that any deviation from safe sleep practice requires a physician's order. This policy is well supported by research. In 2000, research published in Pediatrics, the Journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics, found that of 11 state studies, Minnesota has the highest rate of SIDS in child care settings, 40%. As a result, the Minnesota legislature, in their wisdom I may add, promulgated a regulation in 2001 that requires all licensed child care providers to have training in SIDS risk reduction. This training includes the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation that all healthy infants be placed to sleep on their back. Since this mandated training, the SIDS rate in licensed Minnesota child care settings has declined from 40% to approximately 9%. It is imperative that child care providers be allowed to follow evidence-based medicine and the safe practices that they have learned through their required training. In conclusion, fast sleeping for healthy infants is the standard of care throughout the United States and the world. Parents expect that licensed child care providers are required to follow safe infant care practices. Placing healthy babies on their backs to sleep has contributed to dramatic decline in the infant mortality rate and must continue to be the practice in child care settings. We support the proposal that only a medically required exemption to this practice, documented by a health care provider, be allowed in licensed child care settings. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, there is a copy of both testimonies in your packet, so if you'd like to follow along, it's helpful. So thank you. And welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
My name is Colleen Lindstrom. Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and Council members. My name is Colleen Lindstrom, and I'm here to tell you about somebody who's, I'm sorry, this is a very hard story. Somebody who's very important to me, and that is my firstborn, my daughter, Brady Judith Lindstrom. She is the child who made me a mom and made my husband a dad, but I don't get the chance to talk about her very much anymore because she's not alive.
It's okay. Take your time.
Yeah.
A lot of parents in the room.
Yeah.
So
it's a hard story. My daughter died when she was 3.5 months old under the supervision of a licensed daycare provider in the state of Minnesota. Brady was born on March 19, 2005 at 11:56 p.m. And just as all first-time parents do, we immediately began making plans for our daughter. My husband was already walking her down the aisle when she was only minutes old, and I was busy panicking about her first day of kindergarten. But in those midnight hours of March 19, 2005, we had no idea that we would never see either of these events. In April, as I was anticipating returning to work after a normal maternity leave with my very healthy baby, we began the arduous task of visiting daycares. We had decided to put Brady in daycare part-time and felt really good about that decision. We were confident that when we chose a daycare, they were going to take the best care of our treasured baby. In fact, when we visited the daycare that we ultimately chose, they reassured us so effectively of their policies regarding sleep positions that we never even felt the need to ask or remind them of our wishes that Brady be placed on her back to sleep as advised by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Although I remember a conversation we had filling out the paperwork to enroll her when we checked off the box noting that Brady was a back sleeper. We couldn't imagine that these days anyone put their children to sleep on their stomach. We've gotten plenty of education from the time we became pregnant until the time we left the hospital. I remember wondering why that question was even there. I was certain that the providers knew that the safest way for infants to sleep was on their back. Besides, they had been so vocal to us about their policy. But we went ahead and filled out the paperwork notifying them of our preference and thought nothing more of it. We assumed that they would follow our wishes and their very own policy. Each day, I was amazed that I could love our daughter more and more. We marveled at each new skill she developed, each new sound she made, each new expression that she revealed. She was perfect. She seemed to be really happy at daycare, and we were so pleased at how they adored her at her daycare center. And then, on July 5th, I had plans to pick Brady up after work and take her for a walk around Lake Harriet. It was a beautiful day, and I just wanted to share it with my girl. But as I exited the freeway just blocks from her daycare, I found myself behind a squad car. I followed the squad car all the way to daycare, where there were a number of emergency vehicles parked. As I rounded the corner of the building's entrance where I would normally see Brady's beautiful, smiling face, instead I was met with the pained faces of her caregivers. It was my baby that all those cars had come for. It was my baby who had stopped breathing. The details following that moment are too painful for me to share here. I only know that at that moment we had found ourselves on an unending road of grief. This is my sad story. I am a bereaved parent. In the days following Brady's death, the details about exactly how she died became clear to us. Against our instruction, against their own policy, and against the standard of the care expected of licensed child care providers in the state of Minnesota, Brady was placed to sleep on her stomach by a licensed daycare worker. When she was found, her head was turned face down in the crib. When asked why Brady was placed to sleep on her tummy, the daycare provider answered, "I don't know." Whether being on her tummy put Brady at risk for SIDS or suffocation, Brady's death was preventable. Our daughter's death has affected us in ways that would never occur to parents who haven't faced this type of loss. We have since had a subsequent child whose name is Oliver. We call him Ollie. And of course, we did not put him in daycare. I couldn't trust that anyone would take proper care of my child, and the risk was just too painful. We made the difficult decision to drastically reduce my hours at work and rearrange our schedule so that Ollie can be in our care constantly. I believe that the more attention daycare providers are forced to give safe sleep environments, the less likely it will be that babies will be put at risk during the vulnerable sleeping hours. I believe that had this bill been in place when my daughter was alive, our daycare provider would have made a different choice, and that would have been a choice that would have saved my baby girl.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. I know it's very, very difficult. We appreciate you being here today. It is when legislators hear stories like yours and hear about your life and what you've gone through, it helps us make better decisions. So it's very good that we had you here today. Members, are there any questions? Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's just, I was clarifying why you feel the doctor would be a stronger directive to the daycare center rather than the parent. I mean, why the change in the language? It seems like a directive from the parent should be enough to, you know, for the daycare providers to be doing this, but I see you have the doctor, so... I didn't understand that, you know, that in the testimony so far, I haven't understood why the change in the language.
Right. As I understand, sorry. Just go through the chair, so I call on you, and then you go back. So, Ms. Firmbeck.
Thank you. As I understand the rewording, prior to this rewording, the parent could ask the daycare provider to have their baby put on their tummy. And what the Okay. What we're proposing and what the American Academy of Pediatrics urges is that the only time a baby is put on his tummy in daycare is because of a medical condition, and that the daycare provider obtains a medical prescription from the doctor that tummy sleeping is required, and that the standard in daycare should be back sleeping. Representative Peter, did that clarify it?
Yes, thank you. And it certainly seems to be a much safer situation then, because there would be no deviation. And the other way, there could not be. Thank you.
Representative Eastman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Whose responsibility would it be to get the doctor's directive? I mean, from a parent's point of view, I mean, I would think if the doctor had required a baby to be put to sleep on their stomach, they would have told that to the parent, and the parent would know that. I'm reading the law, and the way the law reads now, it says that a license holder must place an infant on its infant's back for sleeping. I mean, clearly, as tragic as this story is, I mean, that was already by law an inappropriate action, so I guess what I'm trying to understand is, are we by taking this decision away from parents and requiring it to be a doctor's directive, are we just putting another financial burden on parents? Because I would think a parent would know that if they've been getting, you know, doing their checkups with their infant, and that would be something that the parent would be involved in. So I guess I'm just kind of trying to understand what this would really change, except it's going to add some cost to a parent to have to go to a doctor and get a doctor's statement.
Ms. Fernbach, yeah, thank you. The language now says that a parent can have the baby put on their tummy. What's occurring is that parents who may be making another choice are asking providers to have babies put on their tummy without any medical reason. And so what's happening is that not only are babies putting in harm's way in a licensed facility, and that the providers are getting training, that the parent is asking me to do something that I know is not safe. So that's one issue in terms of what's occurring with the language prior to this language, where only a parent's request allows the daycare provider to place the baby on their tummy.
Representative Eastland?
I'm thinking of a different way that we could accomplish the same thing that would maybe be less cumbersome for parents. What if we constructed this language to say that this is required unless there are medical reasons? And so a parent could not just request for any reason. The parents would only request if there were medical reasons.
Okay.
But the parent would still know that. And so if they came and said, I want you to put my son or my daughter to sleep on their stomach, and you say, is there a medical reason for that? And if there wasn't, then you couldn't do it.
Yeah. Ms. Fernbach? Unfortunately, in the real world, that's not always how it occurs in terms of parents making those requests. And I think in terms of a provider feeling that they're doing the best thing for the baby based on what they know is safe. And again, according to what the American Academy of Pediatrics is certainly directing healthy child care providers to do, that request from a doctor gives a very clear understanding that back sleeping is medically required, and that everyone is doing the right thing by this baby in a licensed facility. Follow up, Representative Eastland?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, we oftentimes try to just reconstruct the law to make it stronger and stronger and stronger, but I mean, this already kind of says that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I think with just a little bit of tweak, if there was some medical reason, and I, in my opinion, as a parent, I mean, I think a parent is more concerned about the child, and if the parent is aware that there's a risk, and if that's part of the process, that when they bring their, if they would say that I want my child to sleep on their stomach, and then they could be educated more about the risk, and if there was not a medical reason, the parent is certainly capable of making a decision. So I guess I, I'm I always get a little concerned when we stick professionals in between parents and say parents aren't capable of making decisions. I think they are, and I'd like to see a law that bolsters that relationship as well, rather than just make another requirement on a parent, kind of indicating they're not really able to make this decision.
Ms. Fernbach? Well, just that I think for daycare, I understand your concern in terms of parents being able to make these determinations. I think in a licensed facility, though, not only do parents expect that providers are following the standards of care, and the fact that they have a license gives that kind of credibility and faith to a parent, but I think child care providers, by virtue of going through their license, also expect that the state or the county that licenses them will support them in providing safe care. So I think there are issues on both sides in terms of people doing what they are taught is best. And it just seems as though, in terms of the kinds of things that we see in Minnesota, and I think that are being seen in other states, that even though a parent may say a baby should be on their tummy, medically, oftentimes, there is no reason for that. So that child is put at risk, that provider is doing something that she knows isn't safe. I hear what you're saying in terms of adding financial burdens to parents, but when we see these children who die on their tummies unnecessarily, and sometimes parents have asked for that to be, it seems like we in a licensed facility need to be mindful of standard of care. Representative Norna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question just to clarify something in my mind. We're referencing infants here in this this legislation, and I'm just wondering, is there a magic, at what age does an infant then go to, I'm just wondering at some age they're going to be rolling over on their own, so I'm just wondering at what point doesn't this apply anymore in a child care?
You must be a father.
Yes.
You're right. That we look at this up to a year.
Okay.
And as you know, babies start rolling over, about 5-6 months? And that the recommendation is once babies start rolling over, they're on their own.
Okay.
And that the recommendation continues to be that the parent and provider always place the baby in the crib on their back. If baby starts rolling, you don't need to be checking on the baby all the time. But we also urge providers and parents that this is another time to look at where you're putting the baby to make sure baby's in a safe place. No pillows, no bumper pads, no bedding, no blankets, so that when baby does start rolling around, they're not going to become entangled in anything that might be in the crib.
Okay. I knew there was,
right,
but I wasn't sure what age it was. So thank you very much.
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, Ms. Fernbach, I missed part of the testimony regarding the medical reasons that you would put the child on their stomach.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question I have is, would there be situations that are where the parent wouldn't need to go to the doctor anyway to determine whether those medical conditions apply?
No.
So, Madam Chair, so I guess the question then becomes, if this is a rule, then essentially the parent would have to go to the doctor anyway, and at some point, I mean, I've dealt with this a lot, not this week, but last week, about getting the right kind of doctor forms filled out to get to daycare on time so the kid can go there that day.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the offices are pretty good. If you've been in there to deal with the situation, they'll fax something over or do something like that. And so it seems like if you have to go to the doctor anyway, that wouldn't be such a great burden. From my point of view, anyway. And I guess the other, maybe this was also addressed, but if you have a kind of a bright line rule, an expectation that this is always how it's done, except in those rare circumstances when you have a doctor's note saying something otherwise, it helps reinforce kind of the good habits and the good practices. But, and by having a clear rule with a very limited exception, I think you maybe help engender that kind of good practice.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, absolutely. And in these licensed facilities, we want to practice. We want to do best practices, do the right thing for our infants and children. Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm thinking my grandchildren. At what age can they have toys in there? Because I got a 2-year-old. There's no room for him in the crib.
I think he's okay. I said we look at after a year.
after a year. But I think by the time they're two, American Academy of Pediatrics said that two, they can also have a pillow when they sleep, and so I think toys are okay.
It better be, because
we're always learning.
You can't find the baby. Representative Peterson.
I think Representative Winkler said it all, Mr. Chair, except that I also, as I'm listening, think that this is probably also a safeguard for the child care facility and those child care workers, because it's very clear then, and they don't have to be worrying about what the parent wants, etc., and it, you know, and get confused at some point. This makes it very, very clear, and I think it's a safeguard from litigation, quite frankly, but so I'd support it.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions, members? Representative Eastland?
And that sparked a thought here when Representative Peterson. What then would be the consequence, or what would be the course of action if there was a situation where there was a SIDS death in a licensed care, and how would the liability for that work? Would there be, if there had been a negligence on the part of a licensed care worker, is then there a full-blown lawsuit? Is that a wrongful death kind of a...
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not with licensing, so you'd have to redirect that from that. Ms. Lindstrom, anything to add?
Well, what I would add is that, and I can't really say much about this, but in my case, certainly we did follow up. And because this we had not requested that she be put on her stomach. However, I believe that if she would have had a medical reason to be there, we would have had a doctor's note. That would have clarified even for the daycare that what they had done was proper practice. But as they did in my case, it was not proper practice.
Representative Norness.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Just to clarify again, this new language specifies doctor. Would a nurse or a nurse practitioner also suffice? Is that included when you say doctor?
Yes. I think if you need to put healthcare provider, perhaps that would be appropriate. Are there any other questions?
That's up to the author.
Here's what it would have to be. It would have to be a licensed doctor or licensed nurse practitioner. It could not be a nurse. A nurse does not prescribe. So it would be of the, am I correct, doctor? I think so. A doctor's order is what we're looking at. And nurse practitioners do write doctor's orders, and I think that would be the level that we'd have to go to.
I think, members, this bill is going to be laid over for consideration, as I think that if you have concerns, maybe you can work with the author on that, and we could continue to have this discussion and just make sure if you have some concerns in talking with
I would only recommend that maybe you look at amending it at some point to just clarify that.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Speaker. Just on that point, I think that, again, if we're talking about an infant with a medical problem, so have been a medical diagnosis, and that can be transmitted by the medical diagnosis, and the order from the doctor can be transmitted by other people in the clinic. So I think administratively, if it says doctor, it's still going to be transmitted by others, but it might be clearer and more administratively simple to leave it with the physician who's going to make the medical diagnosis and make that order.
Mm-hmm. Members, any other questions? Well, thank you, Representative Fritz, for bringing this forward. Thank you, Ms. Lidstrom, for sharing your story. And thank you, Ms. Fernbach, for clarifying the details today. And we appreciate you sharing your time with the legislature, and thank you for coming down.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 3197 be laid over for inclusion in the Omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee bill. Next, we have House File 2976, Representative Murphy. Murphy.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I would like to move House File 2976 for possible inclusion in the early childhood omnibus bill.
That's Representative Murphy moves that House File 2976 be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the early childhood learning finance omnibus bill. Members, we did hear this bill last session. It was part of, and it was part of our omnibus bill, so you may remember it. But it was taken out in conference. We will be hearing bills over the next few weeks that we heard last session, but we were unable to fund. So we all understand, of course, especially after today, that there's a deficit, and we want to keep these issues before the committee just so you're aware of what's happening, although we are aware of the budget deficit. So with that, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I couldn't have said that better myself. Ted Dunphy is here to talk about the language of the bill, and I'd like to turn it over to him.
Welcome to the committee. If you could say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Chad Dunkley. I'm president of Minnesota Child Care Association and also with New Horizon Academy. I want to thank you so much for considering looking at reinstating the Part A rate, and thank Representative Murphy. Before the amount came out last year, this was a lot cheaper. It gets more expensive every year to fix some of these things, too, which is, of course, frustrating for all of you, I'm sure, and certainly for providers. But I did want to explain why the Part A rate has such an impact on the system for providers, families, in particular families, but also for counties. There's not just the financial cost. There's administrative frustration and burdens in the fact that we've eliminated a reimbursement rate that really exists in the marketplace. But to explain that, sometimes I think people, in 2003, I think we cut child care assistance in significant part because I think the state thought that they controlled the cost of child care. In truth, 90% of child care in Minnesota comes out of parent pockets. 10% of child care comes out of government pockets. 5% of that is the federal government. 5% of that is the state. I think about Rolnick was here, he'd say, as an economist, you don't control rates when you only control 10% of the market. And what's happening is we've tried to change child care to save money by eliminating what's happening in the marketplace. And so for families who are trying to purchase child care, low-income families who are getting child care assistance help, the reason the federal government sets requirements and says, make sure that your rate reimbursement system matches market practice, because we want families to have equal access and parent choice. Well, when we eliminated the Part A rate, we eliminated a lot of choices for families, because we have a lot of providers who don't offer, they either offer full week services, full day services, or part day services. And in all of those cases, what that does is reserve a space for the family so they can get access to care. And what the state's done when eliminating the Part A rate is said, we'll only pay you hourly. Well, in the rest of the world in childcare, hourly means that's not guaranteed. That means, you know, the space is on a first-come, first-served basis. And you really need to call in advance and ask for care because you don't have a space reserved for your child. So many families, particularly for before and after school care, are not getting access to care because the counties and state will only authorize on an hourly basis. I know in some cases, providers would say their hourly rate is more, and in some days they're getting paid more than the state would pay if there was a Part A rate. In some cases, they're getting paid less, but it varies by day. But and in addition to that problem, and many providers have said, fine, this is too frustrating and discouraging, it's not just the cost for these families of then having to pay the difference between what is the Part A rate and the hourly rate the counties will pay, but we have county workers, providers, and families every day dealing with frustrating issues when it comes to this. I'll give you an example. I know I asked a staff person in my office, I said, so give me an example of a frustration with not having a Part A rate exist. And she said, I've been talking to a Dakota County worker, and I won't name names, who thinks that you can get from Minneapolis to Lakeville in 30 minutes. Well, today with snow, certainly not. Maybe in a few years after the transportation bill, you'll be able to. But if you live in Lakeville, that's not real possible. And the problem with that is the county worker will only authorize 30 minutes. So they get, if the family gets off work at 4:30, they get till 5, or I think it's 5 to 5:30. Well, the child is only authorized for 2 hours of care. And if they go over that, then the family's got to pay the difference between the reimbursement rate that the provider charges and the state maximum. They also have to pay their family copay, but now they have to pay for that extra hour, and they're having to do that virtually every day. And that's because they're only authorized for a certain number of hours of care. But some days, of course, the other issue is in the morning, somebody could be asked to come into work early. Basically, hourly care doesn't reserve a spot for a family. It doesn't guarantee them a spot, and working families need a guaranteed spot. So many families don't have access to than any types of care. And then we also have county workers and providers and families having to deal with all these frustrations with authorizing on this basis that really the market doesn't use for most services. So reinstating the Part Day rate is more expensive than we once thought, but there's a lot bigger problems than the cost in the system. It doesn't reflect what's happening in the market for families. And as rates stay frozen and we keep having more and more challenges, this problem is growing for families who need Part Day care. So we do hope you do consider it, and it will save a lot of administrative burdens for everyone in addition to the cost that it will bear, but it will give families access to different and more options for them. Thank you.
You know, we're going to have Ms. Adrian go over the fiscal note. We have a three-page fiscal note, members, that should be in your packets. These days we get very detailed fiscal notes, so for us to understand that, I'm going to ask Mr. Dunkley a question real quick, and then I would like you to go over this. Ms. Adrian, now with MSEP, isn't it a 20-hour a week work requirement? So wouldn't the minimum amount of hours be 20 hours?
Madam Chair, the issue is the county will look at, it's often school-age care. These are children who are in the schools during the day. This is the most common problem that I personally experience. I can explain the other one, too, is infant care and school-age care, where providers often don't offer hourly because they may be working full-time even, but the children come back to our center, let's say, 3:30. They get off work at 4:30 or 5. They're only budgeted from 3:30 to 5:30 in the space, so they only pay for 2 hours because they're with us that time. Yet our program is open from 3 till 6:30, and we have a fee for the space. And actually, I think my fee is less than 3 hours, but more than two, at least in my personal circumstance. So if they end up staying, going to full 3 hours, it's actually a higher cost than it would be if you just paid me a part-day rate. But at 2 hours, it's less. So it just isn't reflecting the market. But truly, if you came to me and asked for before and after school care, I wouldn't offer you hourly before and after school care. I charge for the slot because I can't send the staff home and I can't put another child in the spot when you don't come. It's just not the way the market works. And the state eliminated it, even though they're really supposed to be having financial policies that reflect what does the market do, and that's really where child care is available.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Adrian?
Madam Chair and members, you'll see on your fiscal note, it's for House File 2976, and it's the fiscal impact would only be an impact to the state. And in fiscal year 08, it's pretty negligible. It's a $9,000 amount. And then in fiscal year 2009, it would be $817,000. And then the real use would jump up in 2010 and 2011 to about $2.2 million for each year. And what the department projected, the estimates were based on an increase of children that are currently using the MFIP and the basic sliding fee programs. And so it would be an increase of 3% of the children currently using MFIP would shift from the hourly rate to the half-day rate, and then 6% of children who are using basic sliding fee would shift from the hourly rate to the half-day rate. Feel free to ask me any other questions if you want more detail than this.
Members, any other questions? We're seeing a lot of figures here, so Representative Eastland?
What happens, there's some pretty significant growth in the numbers that we have here. Are we assuming that it remains relatively flat from there out, or are we what goes on beyond this? I mean, when there's that much change, things are doubling or more than doubling every year. That seems like it's something we should be understanding its longer-term impact.
Ms. Adrian?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, that's a good, valid point. And what this estimate is based on is the idea that the payments are going to be projected to increase proportionately according to the forecasted average monthly payments. And so, you know, looking at this, I would assume in the 2010-11 biennium, that would be more of a, that cost would be more of the level cost. But it does, the numbers and the payments that are necessary really do fluctuate based on participation rates in the program. So that's, you know, that's what we get from all the forecast numbers, from the November forecast and the February forecast. You know, that's where we can see that those numbers change. So it's really hard, I think, for the agency to go farther out than this. But I would, my guess would be that, you know, the $2.2 million, that is a pretty standard cost.
Representative Eastland?
And another question, maybe Mr. Duffy, maybe you could answer this. Does this cost kind of structure that we're seeing going out here, does this represent more people using child care services? Is that what's reflected in this cost, or is this just a shift of how the dollars are coming up with to pay for child care services that are already happening?
Mr. Dunkley?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, when I'm looking at how this is calculated, I see only a calculation accounting for the difference between an hourly rate that's being paid now and what half-day rates look like they are. To be honest, I would assume a lot of families who have moved out of center-based care and some other more formal arrangements into less formal, there probably is some cost associated with they may choose a different type of care. But I don't see that necessarily calculated. What I also don't see calculated, which is a surprise, is that the state will actually save money in some circumstances where they're paying, let's say, 3 hours of care that costs more than the half-day rate would be. And I know those circumstances happen, and they happen in my programs where a family's paying for an extra hour and it's too bad they weren't authorized for a half-day because the rate would have been less than that. And so this may be just the main financial impact. I'm surprised those other factors weren't included.
And I guess that was kind of where I was coming from. It sounded like, from what you were saying, that there would be less, there should almost be a savings at some point, somewhere in here, but we're not seeing that at all, at least in the fiscal note that we have here. Then my last question is, what if we go back to the half-day compensation model, how much time will the state be compensating for when children are not actually in daycare because they are locking up a spot? And so, I mean, in one sense you could say maybe it's cheaper, but if they took a half day, maybe paying for 3 hours still is less than the half day. I don't know. So explain how that works, because obviously if they're tying up a slot, there may be days when they don't come. And I think that was part of the discussion when this was looked at before, was there was a lot of slots paid for that were empty when it came to children actually being there. I mean, as I recall, I was on the committee that when we discussed this at the time, there was a cut was made. So I guess I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about that issue.
Mr. Duckling?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, most of that, it's much more limited now because in addition, in 2003, we created an absent day limit. So families can only have so many absent days, and then the state stops paying for those, so they can have some days off. But even with hourly, if they're authorized for a guaranteed number of hours, which some counties do, it's very frustrating because counties are just as challenged by this rule because they can't match market practice, but some counties will guarantee hours because they can't get a provider to even take the children. They'll still end up allowing you to charge for those hours under absent days. But it just isn't reflecting market practice. But absent days, really, you can only have so many a year, and then you either lose your spot or you have to start paying for every day you're gone from there forward.
And apparently the staff in DHS is here if we want to talk with them more, if they want to, I'm not sure if that person wants to come forward. Representative Eastland?
Yeah, you brought up one other issue. Maybe it would be good to clarify that. So what is the number of absent days that a child can be absent from a daycare and still not affect the payment scale, and is that the same number for half days, or how would that work?
Maybe we should have DHS answer that.
Sure.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
My name is Cherie Kotelnik, and I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program. The maximum number of absent days, the current policy for that is 25 on an annual basis with no more than 10 consecutive absences. There are some exceptions for medical considerations.
Representative Eastland?
Yeah, so how would that work in the half-day slot? Same, with a half-day absence would count as 1 day of absence?
Right, if you're authorized for, yes, it would. Madam Chair.
Ms. Kotelnik, weren't there, I know we worked on exceptions for teen parents and things like that. But
Madam Chair, those were components that were passed with a later implementation date. So those are some other things that we've been talking about with you and language for whether they could be supported by computer earlier or not, and which parts of the bill that we passed last year could be implemented more quickly.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we do any statistical analysis of how many days the state pays for when children are absent from daycare on an aggregate scale?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, we, as you probably know, are in the process of rolling out the statewide computer system. We will have more data to be able to analyze in that level of detail at the point in time that that's fully implemented. We expect that that will be by the end of 2008, probably earlier than the end of 2008. So we're all looking forward to the day when we can analyze this more closely. I will say that at the point that the half-day rate was eliminated, it did have a major effect on programs that charge in session rates. And before and after school care generally charges session rates. They charge an amount of money for whatever amount of time the child comes, and that was a major impact. Similar experience happens in preschool, but there are less families in the child care assistance program who use preschool for their child care needs. They would use child care programs then. One of the major differences between the fiscal note this year and the fiscal note in the previous year is that in the previous year, the policy change applied only to school-age programs.
Representative Eastland?
Yeah, just maybe one final comment. Kind of recalling the discussion that we had, I think, at the time when this policy was put in place, and I think it, if I recall, it goes something like this. I mean, we already allow 25 days that a child can be absent from child care, and the state still pays. So I'm not saying every child uses that. I mean, that's kind of the max and wherever it is. And so now we're going to move that policy to the half day time as well. And so basically what will happen here is that there'll be a lot more time when the state will be paying for child care when a child won't be there, if we're going to be buying slots rather than hours. So I think we should understand that's where we go with this. And that's why it's costing more money, because we're paying for more slots when kids aren't there. That's the only reason it's costing more money. So the point is that and I'm not saying we this is a good or a bad, or we should or we shouldn't. This is a different philosophy, I guess. But I think as stewards of state dollars, we ought to be looking at how we can provide child care at the best rates for the state. It's important that child care providers, you know, can survive and make money and all that kind of stuff. But I think we need to look at both sides of this equation and be careful. And because it's not a lot of money initially, but it does, a couple million dollars turns out to be quite a bit of money. And at this point, every $1 million is pretty significant based on what we heard today. So,
Madam Chair.
Do you Representative Murphy?
Thanks, Madam Chair and Representative Eastland. I think it's a fair point, but I also think we have to make sure that we provide child care that is useful for the families seeking the care. Just to balance both sides of that equation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the other things with absent days, I think it's misunderstood. Child care is a service that's similar in a lot of ways to K-12 when you provide good education. My daughter hasn't been to school all week because of the flu, and she still has a spot in the classroom. And that's the problem. The cost still exists. The teacher's still showing up. They still have to pay the rent. The building costs are still there. And the one thing we do in child care we don't do in other places is we say we don't want families qualifying for child care assistance that don't need it, that really aren't using it, because we have a waiting list of 3,000 families. So I totally understand that, too. We don't want to be wasteful of our dollars. That's why if they're gone for more than 10 days, then the family doesn't get any more absent days. It's not like they can use all 25. But 25 sounds like a lot, but when you have a family, when you're sick or your child's sick, you're home. And typically, then your child stays with you even if you're sick. You have some vacation time and some of those things. But this isn't a service. You're not buying bread. You're buying a slot. You're buying a space. And if I could send my staff home and not pay one-fourth or one-sixth of my business expenses when somebody's gone, I wouldn't have to charge for the space. And I think what we're doing is we're trying to get families into a private market system of child care and treat them like we do every other family. And that's the way the system works, and we're trying to kind of shove our rules into a system that we don't control, which makes it really tough for families, and that's kind of what we're doing here. But I agree with you. We have to have rules so families don't take advantage.
Thank you. Representative Wardlaw?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought Representative Eastland made a good point, and you just made a good point. Is there any studies out there? a parent can't send their child to daycare for that half day, that means they come home from work. Is that what usually happens? And if they don't work, then is there a study out there how much income was lost and how much tax revenue we're losing because they're not working and things like that? That's another side of that coin, because we want to keep people working too.
Ms. Katoma?
Madam Chair, I thought you were going to go a different direction with your question, and I don't know of a study that particularly says that if the parent can't use the child care situation, then what's the impact on the workforce? I do know that if they're not using it because the child's sick, they wouldn't be able to use it anyhow because they can't take the child to child care.
Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Mr. I understand that. The sick part, you had a pretty good comeback for the sick part, or for 25 days anyway. But I want people working. And if they have to stay home because they can't find a babysitter, then that's not good. Maybe they lose their job or more people end up on welfare, maybe. I just like to know if there's any statistics out there, or from your experience, maybe.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, I think there's a ton of national studies that would talk about, and this is true of families, whether they're child care assistants or not. If you're not comfortable that your children are in a safe, good environment, you're either not going to stay at work or you're not going to be very successful there because you've lost focus. And there are lots of studies, which is why companies are spending millions of dollars for quality on-site child care, why all these studies are talking about a good place to put your child. I think there's tons of workforce data. We don't have any good specific data in Minnesota how this impacts the workforce, but there's no question when Hennepin County had somebody tracking, what are some of the biggest issues for people staying in work that are in these programs, child care was like number two, way up there. As if I'm satisfied and have a good child care situation, I'm far more likely to succeed in the workforce. So no question this has an impact on those families.
Okay. Members, we're going to need to move forward. Ms. Katomic, if you have a comment, then I am going to ask you just a couple of brief questions. Ms. Katomic?
I did want to mention the fact that the department is very, very concerned about reflecting the market in the way that we do the market rate surveys and in the way that we apply the policies in the child care assistance program. We realize there's a disconnect right now. And we have actually commissioned a study with the University of Minnesota to help, and I've been part of a national study on market rate surveys to try to determine how to ask the questions, how to select the providers to ask questions, how to determine exactly what the market is doing and to get the best results about what the market rates are. And then the study in Minnesota is on the best practices for applying the information that we gained from the market rate survey to policies and practices in the child care system. So we hope to have a pretty comprehensive report about that before next session for you.
Ms. Katomi, thank you for mentioning that. That's the same committee that we've been to the meetings. I was there, and Representative Bly was there. And I think, probably won't like this if I open it up to the members, but if you're interested in that, there is this study going on about rate setting. It is one of the most complicated topics. It's almost as bad as education finance. But how rates are set for child care is something we really need to know more about, and I hopefully it's okay with you. I'm going to encourage the members, if they want to know more, we're right in the middle of a study. And I think legislators, frankly, like to be involved when the study's going on as opposed to being handed the final product. So if you're interested, see Ms. Kachelnik. The other thing I was going to say is we are working on members from DHS. We will be getting a forecast brief and in relation to how the budget forecast will affect the child care forecast. So if you're interested in that, I guess let us know too. We could potentially open that up to a couple more members. And if you want to see what those are going to happen. Otherwise, we will report to you kind of what we learned there. And then the third thing is to say, members, is I think it's good for us to have this dialogue and to be talking about these issues. In my opinion, though, I think as chair I can say my opinion now and then, is I would like to see child care to be child-centered. We have so many problems with the system of when parents either get a better job and the kids fall off assistance, or they get the reasons they become ineligible, not ineligible, but keeping kids on care, whether it's part-time care or full-time care, so that they can have a consistent situation and work, as you say, Representative Wardlow, and not have to worry about it. I think that's the goal. When over the interim, we went to some meetings on child care, and it is clearly one of the most rule-laden areas of the law, and it just seems like for our parents who are already struggling, we don't, you know, we're not about giving people a hand out as much as a hand up, and it seems like all of our regulations are certainly make it difficult for parents, and I think we're trying to make it easier in some ways, and also to keep those providers in mind. So thank you for the discussion. We'll continue to have a lot of discussion on this. This is a topic that will be up to debate for a while. So thank you, Representative Murphy, and to your testifiers for being here. Thank you. Oh, do you want to...
I'd like to renew my motion to wherever possible inclusion, House File 2976.
Representative Murphy removes her motion to move House File 2976 be laid over for possible inclusion of early childhood and finance onto this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Good. Next, we're going to have a couple of presentations. We're probably down to 10 minutes each. First, we're going to have the Child Care Services Grants and Reports, the Deb Swenson-Klatt, and then we'll have the School Readiness Connections Program and the report on estimated costs for conducting financial license reviews. Welcome to the committee. If you could say your name for the record. I'm not sure whose cell phone is going off.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Swenson-Klatt. I'm the manager of the Child Development Services Unit at the Department of Human Services. And I will try to be very brief in covering two topics today. You have asked for an update on the Regional Child Care Services Grant Program. And I will quickly touch on some of the activities in that program. You might remember that last year the legislature appropriated $250,000 per year for this biennium for this program, and these grants are one of the primary ways that we are able to provide direct assistance to child care providers to increase the supply and improve the quality of child care in Minnesota. The grant program has actually been in existence since 1989, so it's been around a long time. Just a few years after it was established, just a few years after the CCRNR system was established in Minnesota, and as outlined in statute, the grant program is administered locally by 7 district CCRNR sites in the state. So along with training and technical assistance, the CCRNRs in Minnesota have the opportunity to provide these direct grants to providers and improve the quality of care. Since the program was established, we've used a combination of both our federal child care quality dollars and our state general funds allocated to child care quality to support the grant program. In fiscal year 08, we have committed a total of $2.3 million for this purpose, and that includes the $250,000 appropriation of new funds for this year. We expect to have that commit that same level of funding next year. We do have a one-page handout that's titled an Overview of Regional Child Care Services Grants, and you'll see at the bottom there's a chart that describes the number of grants awarded between fiscal years 2005 and 7, and the total amount of dollars requested from providers. We have been able over these past 3 years to meet the needs of about 3/4 of the providers who request funds. And then you'll see the in the total amount awarded column the amount of money that we've been putting towards this purpose. The grants are divided into different pots of funding to meet different purposes and for different types of providers. Most of the providers who receive grants are licensed family child care providers in Minnesota. Of the 2,064 who received, of the 2,619 grants awarded last fiscal year, 2,064 were family child care providers. At the same time, that is just a relatively small percentage, as you might know, of the total licensed family child care providers in the state. We, on average, a grant award is about $822 per provider, so it's not a lot of money going to providers, but it goes a long way, we know, in helping those providers make improvements to their program, everything from adding in an egress window if they need that to meet a licensing requirement, to purchasing curriculum or accessing a training. We know that the grants mean a lot to providers around the state. There is a one pot of funding that is specifically within the grants program available for emergency purposes, and that enables the provider to address an emergency issue that would otherwise force them to close. Wanted to make sure that you knew that last summer we were able to add some additional dollars or redirect some additional dollars to help providers in the southeastern corner of the state with the flood. By virtue of having a grants program like this, we were, and actually the CCR and our Inc. in southeastern Minnesota was able to help many providers whose homes were destroyed or damaged by that flood. So I'll stop there with that overview of the grant program. Would you like the opportunity to ask questions of that before I go on to the training report?
Any questions? Well, I just want to ask a brief one. How much of that money is federal?
Let me look really quick to here. I'm sorry, I actually don't have the federal and state breakout. I believe that it's approximately, it's about half and half, half federal, half state, but I will be glad to get that exact breakout.
I just want the members to know that we have been talking about the federal money, and in some states the legislatures control that further than we do. So we've been meeting over the summer about that, and as you know, and about whether we should have maybe some more input into how that money is spent. So thank you. If you want to go ahead.
All right. Now I'll move on to an overview of several actions that the legislature requested last session to also improve the quality of child care in Minnesota. There were two actions requested. One that we look to ensure that licensed family child care providers have access to opportunities to become eligible to receive a higher rate differential through the If Serving Children through the Child Care Assistance Program. And then another action was that the department identified training that new child care providers must take during their first year of employment on the subject or the topic of child development. And what we've done is package our response on these two actions to you in a report that you should have in front of you titled Child Growth and Development Training for Minnesota's Child Care Providers. And I just want to express our appreciation, actually, for the opportunity to just report. This was a chance for us to really delve into a particular issue within our professional development system that needs attention at a time when we're doing a lot of systems change work in this area. So a little bit of background I'm going to focus primarily on this two-hour training requirement. So a little bit of background on that. The statutory requirements that we address and identify training for the two-hour training requirement are a part of a larger piece of legislation that passed last session to establish or develop an early childhood and school-age care professional development system in Minnesota. And it's through that system development that we approach the work of thinking about identifying training that meets the child development requirements. We are attempting to drive some major systems change work in the area of early childhood and school age care professional development, really attempting to motivate providers to more planfully build the knowledge and skills that they need to more effectively ensure that children are ready for school, particularly at-risk children. One of the foundational documents for that professional development systems change work is found in the back of the report that you have. It's called the Core Competencies for Practitioners in Minnesota. And it defines what the knowledge and skills should be of a of anyone working with young children. And there's a particular core competency around child development that we looked to when we were seeking to understand how to identify trainings for this for the licensing requirements that child care providers take 2 hours of child development training in the first year of their employment. One of the issues that this legislative action that was attempting to address is that the two-hour training requirement is an important kind of cornerstone of what child care providers need to know as they're working with young children. Any provider needs to understand that how children acquire language and how they develop physically and cognitively and emotionally and socially. At the same time, state licensors who are monitoring child care expenses and family child care programs in Minnesota have the responsibility for approving this training that child care providers need to take in their first year of employment. And the law, the licensing law and rule, provides no real guidance on what that training needs to contain. So you asked us to identify trainings that can meet this requirement. And the way that we approached that was to first survey licensors around the state. We were able to connect with 61 licensors, approximately 73% of the licensors in counties who oversee family child care providers. And we also talked to the child care center licensors located in DHS, and we talked to tribal licensors as well. And they told us that there's really not much consistency in how they go about approving these child development trainings, and that they would like some help from DHS in doing that. We also hosted a meeting with stakeholders that are identified in the statute to get their input, and together we synthesized the findings from the survey of licensors, from a scan of existing training that's offered through CCR and our agencies, and the discussion from the stakeholders. And so our findings from all this work, again, are that licensors are looking for more assistance in what to approve. CCR and ours are also looking for that assistance, and there's general agreement that that's important. Where we're going is with that information is building a professional development system that is well underway towards approving, developing training content, and then developing processes for approving both the training and the trainers who provide that training, so that we ensure that there's quality training available. We're also building a professional development registry, a web-based system that will help providers find training and track their training as they move forward on their career path. And we're looking forward to continuing to meet regularly with the stakeholders that we met with around this report and with licensors to continue to best identify the trainings that are required for this two-year requirement, two-hour requirement. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I think we're running out of time, so I think we are going to have to move forward. Thank you for being here. And the School of Readiness Connections Program, Ms. Katilnik. Apparently I have a different agenda than some folks, so thank you for being here. Ms. Katilnik, if you could state your name for the record and tell us about the program.
My name is Sheree Katilnik, and I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program for the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, at one point in time, we had talked about giving a quick overview of the Child Care Assistance Program and then also talking about school readiness connections. The packet that you have includes information on both of those topics, but I would like to ask you whether or not you are interested in getting both of those right now, given the time constraints.
Well, Ms. Katilnik, I think you were short on time. What would you recommend?
I can talk really quickly and give you a sense of what to look for in the family profile and in the Child Care Assistance 101.
Okay, sounds good.
But I will if you have more questions, I can come back and talk about them in depth. The two documents that I'm going to refer you to then at this point for the first part of the presentation are kind of a buffy color and a green color. One of these is just the overview of the child care assistance program, and the other one is the family profile. The family profile is a document that we've been using since 1996 to track the characteristics of families in the basic sliding fee and the child care program. Okay, so for the quick overview here, the Minnesota Child Care Assistance Program, in theory, is designed to provide child care assistance for families so that the child care is affordable, so that children are well cared for and ready to learn, and so that the parents can work and or attend school. In recent years, the program policies have been wrapped more around the parents' attendance at work than they have been around the children in the child care assistance program. And because of the fact that many of the families that we serve are high-risk families with variable schedules and difficult work situations, oftentimes the continuity of care for children is not optimum, and we've heard about that before. The program is administered by counties or local contracted agencies. There must be two ways of applying for the child care assistance program. There are two sub-programs from a funding perspective in the child care assistance program. One of them is the MFIP-DWP child care program and the Transition Year child care program. Both are the two for families who were connected with the CAS assistance program, and those sub-programs are fully funded. So any family who's on those programs and who is eligible for child care assistance could have their child care assistance paid for. On the family profile, page 5 of the family profile gives you some information about the characteristics of the families on the MFIP and Transition Year Child Care Assistance programs, and you can look at that in more detail and ask questions if you want at any time. The other sub-program in the Child Care Assistance program is the Basic Sliding Fee Child Care program. That is for families who are not currently connected with the MFIP program or the Transition Year Child Care program. It's not a fully funded program. It has a capped allocation. It always has a waiting list, or most often has a waiting list.
Briefly, Ms. Kovalik, not to interrupt, but members, this is if there's going to be cuts, we think they might come there. So I just want to point that out. That's the easiest place to do it. So you may proceed.
All right. The family characteristics of families who are on the Basic Sliding Fee program are in page 3 of your family profile. And the history of the waiting list is on page 4 of your family profile. And it also gives the statewide totals of the number of families that were on the program in the most recent month we have data for, which is December of 2007, and the total the total waiting list. I believe your packet might have a county-by-county breakdown of the most current waiting list. Okay? That's all I'm going to say about that. And there are priorities for getting onto the waiting list, and those priorities are shown in both the documents that talk about the waiting list. I'm going to let you read the Child Care Assistance Program general eligibility requirements. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. I want to tell you that you have to be in an authorized activity. If you're in any of these sub-programs, you have to be in an authorized activity in order to be eligible for child care assistance. And the percent of families in each of the eligible authorized activities are in your family profile under the basic sliding fee or the MFIP section. You also have to use a legal child care provider if you're part of the child care assistance program. That includes licensed family child care, licensed centers, licensed exempt centers, and legal non-licensed child care providers, which is a subset of family, friend, and neighbor child care providers. Page 1 of your family profile identifies for you what percentage of families in the child care assistance program in state fiscal year 07 use which type of providers, and there's also a history of changes in choices around use of types of providers on that page. Tell me if I'm talking too quickly. As we have talked about just recently in the last discussion around the policy changes that people were talking about making, the child care assistance program sets maximum rate for that they will pay for the child care assistance for families. We also have co-pays. Page 6 of the family profile is an access page that we've been tracking for a number of years now. It identifies the percent of actual provider rates that are covered by the current maximum rates in the Child Care Assistance Program on a year-by-year basis. And you will note that in 2007, on a statewide basis, we are covering approximately 55% of the family child care rates in the state and 40% of the child care center rates in the state. This does not take into consideration the higher rates that can be paid if someone is accredited, and we can pay the accreditation differential. So there may be more provider rates covered if they are accredited providers. It also doesn't take into consideration the providers that may be covered because we're doing the School Readiness Connections project and paying a higher rate because of that. So that's for your reference and for your information about the Child Care Assistance Program. Are there any questions about that? The last little square on here that we've got is a reference piece for you, and that just tells you where the Child Care Assistance Program Policy Manual and the Child Care Assistance Provider Guide can be found on the DHS website. And that has all of the detailed information about Child Care Assistance Program policies from a worker and a provider perspective.
Mr. Kilmink, I just need to make one clarification on what I said. There will be no decisions on cuts until the governor comes out with his budget. That's my disclaimer. Okay. You can go ahead.
Okay. The next thing that you asked me to talk about is the School Readiness Connections Program. And that is one of the three school readiness initiatives that are happening in the state right now. You've already heard about the pre-kindergarten allowance program, and you already heard about the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation scholarship. The School Readiness Connections project is different and the same. And I'll go through that with you. This is the lavender sheet, and the legislation that implements this is the pink sheet. Let me see. In June and July of 2006, the Governor Pawlenty hosted a summit to discuss strategic early childhood care and education system interventions to improve school readiness for kids. One of the two key recommendations from that Governor's summit related to Child Care Assistance Program. The Child Care Assistance Program is the state's single largest investment in early childhood services. We're forecasted to spend $217 million in state fiscal year 08 and support child care costs for over 33,000 children. I just talked to you about the child care assistance policies and the fact that we wrap around the parents' work schedules and that we don't generally focus much attention on the continuity of care for kids. We just assume that if the parents can work out their work schedules and make it work for their kids, then it happens. This initiative intervenes on that and takes a close look at the children, too. The other thing I wanted to say is that we spend the most money on this, and then it also includes most children that are least likely to be ready for school or have been families with characteristics that make them least likely to be ready for school. So this project was created to provide incentives for selected providers to partner with counties and parents to promote skills and abilities that children served by the Child Care Assistance Program need to succeed in school. The things it's designed to, and this is one way that it's different from the allowances and the scholarships, it's designed to build on the existing Child Care Assistance Program infrastructure and investments. So rather than having the parent apply for an amount of money for school readiness in one place and a Child Care Assistance amount in another place, all the payments for this come through the Child Care Assistance Program if the parent chooses an eligible provider and qualifies for this program. It's focusing on economic stability, so it's supporting the family's work schedule, but it's also focusing on school readiness by allowing more continuity of care for the children and more child-friendly policies. We're bringing in qualified child care providers as partners to achieve positive results for children and families. We are identifying qualified providers through standards that align with the parent aware scholarships and allowances. We align with them because we operate on a statewide basis, and Parents Aware is not available on a statewide basis, and because we implemented several months before the Parents Aware project was implemented. So we looked at the standards that they were going to use, and we used those standards to determine who eligible providers were, but we were not able to build off of the Parents Aware system. We also, in these contracts with providers, allow for administrative and program evaluation to inform future decision making. So they have to give us information that will help us identify how much it's costing us to do this, what sources of funds are being used to do this, whether the administrative practices are efficient and effective, and how the kids are doing. So we have an evaluation component to this.
Ms. Katolik, I just need to say, if you can kind of wrap up, and members, you all know, we say we have session at 6.
Okay.
So we're, and because we started a little bit late, members, because you're here anyway for session, if you can, and we started late, if you could stay for a couple extra minutes so we can get the last testifier in, I would certainly appreciate that. And
okay, we're implementing with $1 million. Another key difference between this and scholarships and allowances is that it's available to families with children from 0 to 5. It's not just 4 and 5 year olds or 3 and 4 year olds. And it serves providers from the entire state. If you want to look on the, we received a lot of applications for this project. A lot of qualified providers applied for it. We selected, based on funds available, we selected 14 providers from 9 counties. And they're going to be serving approximately 220 children over the 2 years that this project is in effect. Priority was given to programs that had average 25% so high concentrations of low-income families in child care assistance programs. We have 4 metro centers. We have 1 family child care in the metro area. We have 5 non-metro centers. We have 4 non-metro family child care providers. A really good cross-section of the kinds of providers that are available to the families in our state. And we're really pleased and proud to announce that many of the providers who were selected are in Head Start Child Care Partnerships, and particularly the family child care providers are going to give us a very good opportunity to look at the relationship between Head Start and child care funding and the quality that can be attained by integrating these services. Our payments began in December of 2007, and the assessment tool that we're using with the children in this project is the work sampling assessment process, so that we can look at it in relation to the score in this assessment.
Thank you.
Can anyone speak faster than me?
Ask Ms. Druff to come forward. The next testifier can come forward. Are there any questions for Ms. Katolik? I think, even though it's fast, it is helpful to us, and know, members, just know that if you have any questions on child care, Ms. Katolik is an excellent resource. So we appreciate the update, and I'm sure we will have more questions as we move along. So thank you.
My name is Phil, in your hand up. Yes.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Plummer-Zaruff, and I'm a manager with a licensing division at the Department of Human Services. And I'm going to be very, very briefly summarizing the report to the legislator on estimated costs for conducting annual family annual reviews that have a child care program, so you should have a report in front of you. Authorizing the legislature required DHS to work with counties to determine the cost of conducting annual reviews in family child care and to report on the estimated costs and also to recommend a proposed allocation formula. The report identifies the specific functions that county licensing agencies and the department would have to perform in order to implement these family reviews, and then the estimated costs and the allocation formula for funding these costs.
It's just, right now they're every other year? Is that correct? So it's every 2 years,
right.
And there was a proposal to do it every year, and this is the study to...
Right now, Madam Chair, members, to me, right now the current law requires every 2 years, and that is strictly what's done. Is 2 years reviews.
Okay.
So this would require annual reviews in all cases. In addition to the 2 year reviews, there are, of course, reviews done pursuant to an investigation.
Please proceed. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the methodology, and basically what we did is we consulted with MASFA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, to obtain county input, and the cost, the assumptions, and the cost, as well as the proposed allocation method, reflect the input obtained from the counties, and we obtain costs from the counties, other areas of the department with regard to appeals, and also from the County Attorneys Association with regard to the county attorney costs. Just by way of really brief background, essentially family child care licensing functions, the majority of those functions are delegated to the county licensing agencies pursuant to statute. And therefore, I won't go through all of the details of that in the interest of time, but counties perform the primary functions related to licensing. And what they do then is when they're ready to make a recommendation for
actually issuing the license, as well as issuing the licensing sanctions, revocation, fines, suspensions, etc. They make a recommendation to the Department of Human Services. We work with the counties to provide technical assistance. We certify the counties to perform these delegated functions. The counties also represent the department, represent the commissioner in licensing contested cases, and the county attorneys perform that representation, and thus the county attorney costs are also considered here. I'd be happy to answer specific questions about that and go into detail, but in the interest of time, I'll just leave it at that. So what we did is we took each of the specific functions that the county licensing and the county attorneys would need to perform based on their salary costs that we obtained from them, and applied the assumptions that were that are identified on pages 3-5 of the report. And to summarize, without highlighting all of those assumptions, essentially, based on those factors, we determine an estimated cost per annual review of $286, and then we multiply that by the number of programs as of July 1st of 2007, which was 12,266, and came up with an estimated annual county cost of $3,508,376 per year. There are county-by-county costs that are reflected on the charts at the end of the report on pages 11 through 13, and you can see that it varies from county to county, of course, based on the number of licensed providers that they would have. So again, that's very quick on the county cost. We did the same thing for the department. We looked at what functions would department licensing staff, as well as legal staff, as well as appeals and regulations staff, have to perform, because the assumption generally there is because of additional annual reviews, we will then have additional annual issuance of licensing sanctions, because about half of our licensing sanctions do result from or follow from a licensing review. So that is primarily what the costs are related to for the Department of Human Services. So then, taking those costs, again, the costs are for conducting administrative hearings, and those are conducted at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and we do pay for those. And so there are Office of Administrative Hearing costs, licensing staff related to issuing licensing sanctions, and also associated with appeals of those sanctions, and then appeals and regulation staff costs. Just very briefly, the way it works is a licensing contested case is conducted at the Office of Administrative Hearings by the Administrative Law Judge. That judge makes the recommendation to our commissioner. Our commissioner then issues his final order. That is the final agency decision. And there are appeals and regulation staff that review that Administrative Law Judge's recommendation and then issue an order. So their costs are reflected as well. Taking all of those costs together then, we come up with a total cost for DHS costs $538,937, and I should note that there was a typo in the report, and so you see a different number there. And ultimately, summarizing, the total estimated cost then, rounding, are $3,508,000 for the county, plus $539,000 for the state. That totals $4,047,000. And that would be the total estimated cost, combined general fund cost. And it should be noted there would be an projected offset of federal financial participation of approximately 40% of the state's cost. Then lastly, the recommended funding allocation was the other part we were asked to do. And in consulting with the counties, it was recommended that the simplest approach would be a single allocation to the counties once per year, and that would be based on a snapshot view of the number of licensed providers that they have, because, again, it relates to the number of providers, the number of inspections that they would have to do. Other approaches recommended were that would be less simpler were a quarterly allocation and reimbursement to counties after reviews are completed. Any questions? I know that was really
thank
quick.
You. A couple of things. Can you get a copy of your report to the members that are absent, or make sure they, I guess it's in their packets, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. I just want to make sure that they see this. Members, every time, you know, when someone stands up on the floor or says something like, well, we should do this annually, now we see, you know, how that costs out. If members have noticed, anytime they're doing a report now, we have so many studies going on that they estimate the cost right on the front page that it was $1,580 to prepare this report. So I think it's kind of interesting to see when the members often think that studies are sort of free, Now with you estimating the cost, that is interesting. I also think I'm surprised that it would be $3.5 million a year, and I think that's why I see the county lobbyist in the audience. Is she wants to make sure that we don't ask counties to pick this up, probably, because we've been asking to pick up a lot of things. But, members, I don't know about you. I mean, I'm surprised how complicated it is to think of one more year of licensing. Any questions? I think this is really good food for thought, and we had not considered this, and I hope, I don't know if we were going to get it before the whole legislature. Is that something you do, since it's a report to the legislature? Do you get it out to all of the members?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I didn't personally provide this, but I believe it goes to the committee chairs of the requested committees. My colleague can answer that, but I believe that is generally the general protocol, is it goes to the chair. Pardon? And the representative.
Okay. Thank you, because it's helpful, and I'm sure as requests like this come up, we can look back at this and say, this was a cost. So thank you for your time and for being here. It was very helpful.
Thank you.
And thank you all, and the meeting is adjourned.